You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day, go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm not.
Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bone. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538 Sports Podcast. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538. With me in the studio, Neil Payne to my right. Hello, Neil.
Hey, Chad, what's up?
Neil, you are a sports writer at 538.
I am.
And a little bit of a sports editor.
Well, this week, you and I are co-sports
Holding down
editors.
The fort.
Look at this.
And across the table, it is our global terrestrial.
Did you write this down, Chad?
No, as you can tell, I'm riffing. It's our global terrestrial executive for all things Philadelphia 76ers.
Okay. Are we talking about the Sixers today?
No.
So
we have you on because your expertise is so broad. It goes beyond that. You cut me off mid-title.
Oh, go carry on, Chad.
And the broader NBA community.
Hi, Chad.
As you can tell, I need to work on my intros. I'm still getting it down. Still making that part
global
of my pre-show routine.
Global terrestrial.
Yeah, that seems a little redundant.
No, you could be global extraterrestrial. We're not talking about the kind of globe.
Okay, we're just going to leave that there.
You're right.
Move on to the show.
It was the suavest introduction you possibly could have managed.
On today's show. it is a show about departures, some of them sadder than others. We're going to talk about Jose Fernandez's death over the weekend and the legacy that he leaves behind and the player that he was from a statistics angle and then also from a human angle as well. And then we'll talk about Les Miles, who was let go from LSU's football team.
Fired.
Oh, you want me to use the harsher language?
Just the euphemism.
Let go. He was asked not to return
to coach
to
anymore.
Coaching.
The guy gets a buyout. He was almost let go and or fired however many times in the past.
True.
He's let go.
He was already kind of being... You're right, because when you let go, it's like the final act.
Right.
When somebody's already distant from you.
He was already like out on that tether, like in gravity between Bullock and Clooney.
He was extraterrestrial.
Oh, look at that.
So then we will move on to Kevin Garnett, who is retiring after 21 seasons in the NBA, and talk about the statistical legacy of Kevin Garnett and whether or not he was ahead of his time for the way that the NBA was played during his prime versus the way that it is played now. All right, on to the show. Over the weekend, Jose Fernandez, a 24-year-old phenom for the Miami Marlins, was killed during a boating accident in Florida. He was scheduled to start on Monday's game against the Mets, had been pushed back a day from a Sunday start and then was killed overnight between Saturday and Sunday. Fernandez, the obits came in and the appreciations came in very, very quickly. And I want to get your guys' thoughts on what you heard. What struck me was how clearly he represented something more than just a baseball player for fans and people who had worked with him. Eduardo Perez, who was his former hitting coach, went on ESPN and spoke very eloquently and very emotionally about what it was like to be in the dugout with him. And I was wondering if we could play a quick clip of that.
Being the professional side, this is the human part. He meant so much to the organization, to the city, to the human community, to the kids. So he's going to be greatly missed. And his impact on the game, wow. Sky was the limit. The kid, the enthusiasm, the love for the game that he had, the love to compete. He never tried to show anybody up. He just wanted to have fun. He risked his life, leaving Cuba with his mom, saved his mom in the middle of the ocean, in the darkness. Wow, we lost him.
So you can hear in there some of the currents about the cross currents of Fernandez's story that really I thought were affecting in the remembrances, and part of what made someone that good, that compelling, was that he was a Cuban defector who had rescued his mom from the ocean on the way in. And so I'm curious for your guys' thoughts when you heard the news and sort of how you're making sense of what was obviously a loss before his time.
Well, before Neil jumps in, because I know that there's a ton of really illuminating numbers about his on the field prowess, just from a casual baseball fan. It's like you knew his name and you knew he was this young star pitcher, but unless you were a daily consumer of Miami Marlins or, you know, the NL East in particular, you might not necessarily know the threshold at which he was operating and how high it was. But what you did know was the story behind his arrival here in the U.S. There's like a great piece on Grantland and about his chase for this baseball dream. And then I think it got to a place with him too, where there'd been so much discussion over the last year about these unwritten rules in baseball and whether or not Bryce Harper is breaking them and how does baseball become more fun. And Jose Fernandez, in the times when I had seen him pitch, he somehow found the gap between not breaking an unwritten rule and yet still bringing personality and fun to the game in a way that you didn't necessarily see a lot of other guys who are bat flipping or smiling in the same way. There's something about the way Jose Fernandez did it that seemed to hit a sweet spot.
There's that great clip of him, and was it Tulowitzki when was on the Rockies, where Tulowitzki hits a liner back to Fernandez on the mound, and Fernandez just
stabs
one of those instinctual plays, just stabs it and smiles, and Tulowitzki says, "You caught that?" Or no,
did you catch that?
And Fernandez says, "Yeah," and then they both smile at each other and walk off the field.
Yeah, it seemed like and this often happens, but after a personality dies, that people have, you know, really glowing things to say. But I think in the case of Fernandez, it really is genuine. Nobody had anything bad to say about him as a person, you know, in the game. And I would say, you know, as a non-casual baseball fan, as, you know, our baseball editor here at 538, somebody who's really plugged in, my first reaction was just a state of shock. And I don't think I really I was in denial about it, I think, for like, you know, most of the morning on Sunday, just because it was, you know, he was such a monumental talent and seemed to have so much. And as baseball fans, you know, we latch onto these pitchers like your Clayton Kershaws and your Jose Fernandez's, and you kind of envision whenever there's a talent like that of what their future holds. And it is kind of a shame that, you know, more people didn't get to see him when he pitched, because he pitched for the Marlins during a time in which they were not, you know, necessarily on the national spotlight. But yeah, you just kind of envision a player with clear, obvious Hall of Fame talent. If injuries and, you know, other things don't get in the way, you see it, you know, play out in your imagination, and it just doesn't ever occur to you that it would be interrupted at this point in the arc of the narrative.
I also had a really hard time getting my head around, obviously, as anyone would when someone passes away before, very unexpectedly, regardless of the age. What I was trying to figure out, too, is whether or not my reaction was partly because pitchers, and this is now, I'm now speaking sort of in a selfish way about my own interaction with Fernandez and baseball, but pitchers go away for 4 or 5 days at a time and then come back, and that's part of the deal with pitchers, is that they are people who sort of fade away and then come back. And for some reason, that was partly in my mind too, that it felt harder to understand that Fernandez wasn't coming back, that someone who had, and especially now with pitchers going away for a year and then coming back with Tommy John surgery, as Fernandez had, it was especially hard to get my head around it because of the role that he played within baseball and my relationship to baseball.
Yeah, I think that that's a really great observation, is that, you know, we probably still are going to kind of, every time we see the Marlins, I don't know how long it's going to be before this isn't the case, but every time we see the Marlins on the schedule, we'll be like, oh, is this a Fernandez game? And then have to like catch ourselves and be like, oh, wait, you know.
So I want to get, I think, a fitting tribute as much as we could, given our show, is that we should talk about his excellence on the field. I mean, the guy was, unlike any other pitcher in the game, given his mix of pitches and his ability to throw 98-99 along with a curveball and a sinker, right?
Yeah, I mean, he was in the midst of the fifth best strikeouts per nine inning season in the history of baseball. Mm-hmm. This is going back to like 1870s. Yeah, this season he was in the middle of it. He also right now is the all-time career leader in fielding independent pitching, which is the metric that kind of isolates what a pitcher can control. So when it came to the things that he could control about his craft of pitching, he literally is the, you know, currently the best ever at that, which I think is like mind-blowing and goes to what you were saying, Kate, that like if you weren't in it all the time and weren't, you know, paying as much attention, it might be easy to kind of miss that, because he was on a team that wasn't really the focus of a lot of national press. But he just was like plying this incredible craft and trade in sort of the anonymity of that ballpark and you know, that the fans, you know, sort of that track record in Miami. So, yeah, it just is a shame that he didn't get a chance to kind of shine on a World Series stage or a playoff stage or anything like that.
Well, Neil, having watched him so frequently, and certainly the numbers bear out his skill, but like, what was it that made him so effective?
Well, you know, I think it's he had really good control in addition to just the pure power. And we talk about, you know, there's a lot of pitchers that throw really hard but can't necessarily, you know, always have command over their pitches. And I think Fernandez just had like a ridiculous array of pitches and had command of all of them.
So I have his Brooks Baseball page up, which is sort of like a way to track every pitch that's thrown. He threw 7,400 pitches that had been tracked by baseball's pitch tracking system, and his four seamer was averaged 96 miles per hour, and his changeup 89 miles per hour, which is like a ridiculously
fast changeup.
Exactly, but the mix of speeds, you know, you're just sort of trying to keep people off. And his curveball was 85 miles an hour, you know, all of that basically generated more whiffs per swing that he could blow it by someone, or the movement also sort of made it not hard to actually put a bat on the ball.
Right, and I think another big part of that that shows up is that he really almost never gave up home runs. If you look at the home runs per nine inning of other pitchers, like Pedro Martinez gave up 0.77 home runs every nine innings. Noah Syndergaard of the Mets gives up 0.83 home runs per nine innings. Roger Clemens gave up 0.66. That's kind of your baseline, is in between, you know, 0.7, 0.8, 0.9, even for really good pitchers. Chris Sale, 0.92. Jose Fernandez only gave up 0.59 home runs per nine innings. So kind of a significantly better rate of suppressing home runs. And that goes to what you were saying, Chad, of just like, it was really hard, especially in combination with the strikeout numbers that he had, to catch up to his fastball and actually put the barrel of the bat on the ball and hit him hard. It just was almost impossible.
So I want to mention one other thing, which it seems like we have to mention, which is that he was a Cuban defector playing in Miami, a Latino player who in a league that is increasingly populated by Latino players. And so it was during the prep pack, or in the prep pack that our producers put together for us, there were two different headlines. One was Jose Fernandez was the future of baseball, and one was Jose Fernandez was the future of baseball and America. And so he was an emblem of the direction that it seemed baseball and sports in general, I think, are heading, which is a more diverse player base and also more diverse fan base. And so that was part of the mystique, in a way, which was that here's a kid who is only 23 or 24 and is sort of, as we spoke about earlier, making baseball more fun, but it's also making baseball more inclusive and have a wider footprint. And I think as baseball itself really tries to figure out what its role is going forward in the American sports landscape, Fernandez and players like him were forerunners for how that was going to develop.
Seems to be like a connection between Jose Fernandez and certainly the Cuban community within Miami. But then you pull back and it seems also like there was a lot of work he was doing, not through his own actual focus on it, but just by purely existing of like immigration in this country and whether, you know, it's a Cuban defector. And it was interesting to even read the rules about defecting from Cuba in light of reading his story in Grantland, like the unwritten rule of like, if you get to Miami, then you get to stay, you know, which is much different than in other parts. But in a way, it was like the joy of his pursuit of the American dream, which sounds so cliche, but seemed very real to him. And also like a reflection of kind of where we are socially and culturally in the U.S.
Yeah. And I think what made it so moving was the fact that he, you know, had been through so much at such a young age. He was 15. He had already been in prison three times and, you know, left Cuba amidst a hail of bullets on a boat. And then, you know, like you mentioned, Chad, saving his mother when she fell overboard at 15. You kind of, you know, can, you know, you certainly can't even like begin to identify with that or understand where he was coming from in that, in the things that he went through, but you can understand the that he played with such joy and played with just this like passion that you can kind of map it to almost being given like this second chance or this chance at, you know, life in America playing this game. He seemed to really want to take advantage of that and live every moment that he was on the field with joy. And one of my favorite clips of him is after Giancarlo Stanton, his teammate, hit a game-tying, it wasn't even a game-winning home run in a game against Washington. The camera just instantly, like, the camera's focused on home plate and focused on Stanton, and Stanton hits it. But then you can see the dugout behind him because of the way the camera angle is, and you can see Fernandez instantly just go into this like paroxysm, this just fit of absolute joy, and he's like, you know, screaming at the heavens in just, you know, pure unbridled happiness and smacking the dugout fence and all that stuff. And it just was like just encapsulated who he was and how he played the game. And I think, you know, there's a reason that everyone across baseball was, you know, feeling the loss really profoundly, you know, and will continue to, not just this week but into the playoffs and into next season and beyond.
Yeah, because like the most common refrain at this point, not most common, but one of the most commons is like, it's a business. And it certainly is, but watching him at the various times I did, it was a nice reminder that it doesn't have to seem that way to everybody watching it.
Right. All right, let's leave it there. And hopefully some of the stats helped people make sense of the loss that came too soon. Before we keep going with the show, a word from one of our sponsors. Hot Takedown this week is sponsored by Stamps.com. These days, you can get practically everything on demand, like this podcast, for example. You can listen to it whenever you want, when it's convenient for you. So why are you still making time-consuming trips to the post office when you can get postage on demand with Stamps.com? Anything that you can do at the post office, you can do right now from your desk with Stamps.com. Buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package using your own computer and printer. And unlike the post office, Stamps.com never closes, so you can get postage whenever you need it, 24/7. Plus, you'll even get special postage discounts with Stamps.com that you can't find at the post office. I think, as discussed previously during these ads, I'm about to get married. I'm going to send a lot of thank you notes. I imagine Stamps.com would be very helpful for such a task. Right now, you can sign up for Stamps.com and use the promo code ESPN to get this special offer, a 4-week trial, plus a $110 bonus offer that includes postage and a free digital scale. So do not wait. Go to Stamps.com, and before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in ESPN. That's Stamps.com, and be sure to enter the promo code ESPN. Okay, earlier this week, Les Miles, the longtime coach of LSU, was finally fired and or
finally
let go.
There's some editorializing happening.
No, we talked earlier in the show about how what a long process it was, how
Thank
much flirtation
goodness.
There was. And so, as we are not diehard college football nor SEC fans ourselves, we have brought on a guest to help us make sense of the news and of Miles' legacy at LSU. On the other line, it's Lindsey Schnell from Sports Illustrated. She's the host of the Campus Rush podcast. Hi, Lindsay.
Hello. Finally. That does seem, you know, editorializing. It does. Even a little mean.
I thought you were saying, finally, I'm on the show.
Oh, yeah,
like,
true.
You know, you've been waiting by the phone.
No, she was just jumping in to back me up on your editorializing.
Wait, so Lindsay, am I wrong to characterize it that way? I feel like I have heard that LSU is thinking, flirting, rumored to be about to fire Les Miles for at least a few years now.
Right. Well, they tried to stage a coup last year, and it That's failed right. miserably and very publicly. And I think we all thought he had bought himself at least another year. And then in the Auburn game Saturday, it was so weird, right? We thought they won at the end, and then they review it, and it turns off LSU didn't get the snap off in time. Then Auburn won, and it was this huge swing of emotions. What's funny is that, so I live in Portland, Oregon, and the fans in my region were dealing with both duck and beaver losses.
I'm Saturday. A Colorado Buffalo.
Saturday. Yes, yes, Kate. Oh, I hope you are rejoicing.
I am. It's a signature victory.
It was really fun to watch that.
Yes.
But so Saturday night, I was actually on a local TV show talking about Oregon and Oregon State, and we were talking about the Ducks in particular, and they seem to be reeling. Mark Helfrich, their coach, described their loss to Colorado as a train wreck, that he would guess that's what it feels like to be in a train wreck.
Ouch.
And I said on TV, okay, I know we're getting a little ahead of ourselves, but if the Ducks made a coaching change, who do you think they would go after? Because I'm fascinated by that. I love seeing athletic departments that think they're really important go after coaches that are really important and get shot down. I find that amazing. So we're kicking around some names, and I said, well, Les Miles is probably going to be looking for a job soon. But I did not anticipate that he was going to be fired.
Lindsay got Les Miles fired
quite that soon.
Now, let me actually issue our hot take here, because normally we would play an actual take, and then we would decide if it was correct or not. Now, on Around the Horn yesterday, I had to buy or sell the timing of Les Miles firing. So apparently we've all accepted that he should be fired, but it's the timing that we're gonna deal with now, like right in the middle of a season. Now, Lindsay, right. Here was my take, so you can either dismiss it or actually hold it up as honorable and good in the world of college football. I buy it all the way, and I did yesterday on Around the Horn. I'm like, I buy Les Miles firing, and here's why. Okay, because one, he has not evolved in any way, shape, or form. Like, he's supposed to, after last year, when apparently he was down on his knees groveling to, like, keep his job for this year, he was supposed to have evolved the passing game. And we're still in a place where they look like they're playing in the 1950s, LSU. Number two, Neil's shaking his head. This is the hot take I'm issuing. You can rebut it whenever you want. Number two, right, he has this end-of-game chaos that constantly happens, and sometimes it ends up in his favor like we thought it would, and then other times a series of events happens where as if, like, there's no coaching whatsoever, and they've won, like, they've lost, like, a handful of games that way. And so I don't care that it's the middle of the season when you're 2-2 and you had to beg to even get that second season. I mean, not a second, but another season. That's what you get. There's my hot take. What do you think?
Okay, I can see both sides.
No,
you know, you look at no, listen, you look at Miles has not been good the last four seasons, right? He's been 15-11 versus SEC competition. And that is just not going to cut it. In the SEC, you measure yourself against Alabama, fair or unfair. And that's not what's going on in Alabama. So LSU believes that that's not what should go on there. No doubt they have had so much talent over the last few years, and it has been squandered. I still maintain that they should have put Leonard Fournette in at quarterback and seen if he could throw the ball. God knows it couldn't have been worse than Brandon Harris. But as an athlete, Kate, I think it signifies panic to your players. And at this point in the season, this early in September, you have to think about recruiting too, and all the kids now that have time to look at other schools. You know, LSU has been at the top and always been in the conversation college football-wise because of the talent they have, because they win a lot of recruiting battles. It's easy to when you can prep up the prestige and the honor and the history of LSU and the SEC. Now all these kids can go around and look at other schools, maybe drop their verbal commitment to LSU and commit elsewhere.
Neil's got some stats he's going to jump in here with. I can see because he's been Googling away.
Well, I was just going to say that I think it's really interesting that when you brought up, Lindsay, the idea of recruiting as being this separate kind of idea from coaching, that's what I find kind of fascinating about college football coaches, is because you really do have to do these two very different jobs, and you can be really good at one and then kind of poor at another one, and it can almost work against you to be a better recruiter than you are a coach.
We should know that LSU is one of the three teams that has had a top 15 recruiting class since 2006 every year.
So then you're a great recruiter and you bring this talent in, but if you squander it,
is that somehow better than not having the talent in the first place? Because if you're LSU, if you're Les Miles, you can kind of point to all of these kind of high points that you have in, say, the AP rankings or whatever. They've ranked in the top five consistently every single year at some point or another, yet they haven't finished the season in the top five since 2011 when they lost the BCS championship, and they've only won one BCS championship or the equivalent in the Final Four era. So it is kind of this question of, is it better to be kind of a not as good of a recruiter? I mean, obviously, we would love to be Nick Saban and kind of be able to recruit and then also coach them up. Yeah, and do all of it. But if you had to choose kind of one area that you would be better at, would you be a Les Miles, or would you be someone who, you know, kind of can't recruit as well but can really, like a Paul Johnson or someone like that?
I think you got to be both. Is it that hard to be both?
I think being able to develop talent is going to be huge when you walk into a recruit's room, a recruit's home. You can talk about when you are in the 5- and 4-star home, you can say, look, I developed all these 2-star guys who are nothing into NFL players. Think of what I can do with you. Because that's what kids care about. Can you get me to the league? Can you make me better so I can be a professional player? And do you have cool stuff in your locker room? That's really what it's about.
And cool uniforms.
You got to have a Nike deal.
I think you would rather be a good developer of talent, but I'm not sure. I agree with Kate, too. Like, why can't you be both? Because the other thing is that if hire around you, that's the mistake Les Miles made, okay? Cam Cameron got fired, too, their offensive coordinator, because she's right. The offense hasn't evolved. We've all witnessed that. You don't have to be a college football junkie to watch LSU now and be like, this is basically the same team I saw 5-10 years ago offensively. So if you are an awesome recruiter, then hire awesome X's and O's guys.
So, Lindsay, what I'm a little confused on is why the recruiter and the developer and the coach all have to be the same person. Like, what messianic ego complex thing
they
is
don't
happening?
I mean, nobody, Nick Saban obviously is not doing all the groundwork of recruiting himself,
right? So if Les Miles is really good at recruiting, then Les Miles should be a recruiter, take the pay cut, do something you're good at rather than be pilloried by the media over and over again every week, and let someone else coach. That's okay.
Do you think there's a lot of self-awareness going on?
This is my issue.
No kidding.
Yeah.
This is a sport where there's a lot of egos to manage, and that's before we get into the coaching rooms, you know, just the kids. But no, and like I said, he could have done that. He could have hired a different offensive coordinator. He made a choice not to. All that being said, I don't believe in firing someone in the middle of a season, barring a major legal scandal.
Neil, there's your next assignment. Is it better or worse? Does the team play better or worse on like a 3-year timeline? Mm. If you fire a college football coach midseason,
does it actually set you back?
That's what we need the analytics to answer. So that, Neil.
Next time on Hot Takedown.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if maybe LSU actually kind of jumps out and plays better at this point, because we've seen studies just at the pro ranks, and I haven't seen this in college, but that, you know, you're firing a coach in combination of not only them doing a poor job of coaching, but also just kind of bad luck. We mentioned that, you know, the triple zeros on the clock at the end of that game, if they had just managed to get that snap off a little bit faster, they would have won that game, and probably Les Miles would still be coaching, for now at least. And so it's kind of, once you bottom out in both talent and luck, or you know, coaching ability and luck, there's nowhere to go but up. So it might be a situation where LSU progresses to the mean and plays better, and they would have played better if they had just kept Les Miles.
All right, we've now filled out our bingo card. Progress or regress to the mean has been set on Hot Takedown.
Buffaloes as well.
That's true. We can leave it there. Lindsay Schnell, host of the Campus Rush podcast, part of the Sports Illustrated Network. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me, you guys. I really appreciate it. We'll talk more, Kate, about Colorado in the coming weeks, I'm sure.
And the coffee shops in Portland, Oregon. Offline, we'll do that.
I forgot about your thing with Portland coffee.
Perfect.
And before we keep going with the show, one more word from one of our sponsors. Hot Takedown this week is sponsored by DraftKings.com. At DraftKings.com, you do not need to come in first place to cash in. The player who finished 800th in week one's biggest fantasy football contest took home $100. This weekend, DraftKings is hosting another huge fantasy contest with over $1 million in total prizes up for grabs. DraftKings, to remind you, is the destination for one-week fantasy football. One-week fantasy means no season-long commitments. You play whenever you want, with the players you want, against whom you want. All you do is pick your contest, draft your team, and you can follow the action live as the players play. So do not wait. Get to DraftKings.com right now and choose your players for this weekend's NFL contest. Enter promo code TAKEDOWN while you're there and play for free with your first deposit. That's promo code TAKEDOWN to play for free for your share of over $1 million. In total prizes this weekend. Only at DraftKings.com. Eligibility restrictions may apply. See the website. Yes, that website, DraftKings.com, for details. Okay, now on to the NBA, where Kevin Garnett is retiring after 21 seasons in the NBA. He was drafted out of high school, much like Kobe Bryant, who also retired last year. In my mind, they always sort of go together because of that, because they were part of that last era of, or I guess first era. First era of stars coming straight from high school and having big expectations when they were rookies. 21 seasons in the NBA, 1,462 games, 970 of them for Minnesota. He technically retired as a Timberwolf.
He's a single wolf.
A lone wolf.
So Sports Illustrated, upon his retirement, published an article called Remembering the Kevin Garnett Revolution. And I was curious if you guys sort of picture Garnett as a revolutionary basketball player, because I'm not sure I did before prepping for this segment.
I think of him as revolutionary more off the court than on it when you first say that, because of the guaranteed contract he got that kind of led to a lot of the labor dispute and then bigger, higher ceilings for guaranteed contracts. And I feel like Kevin Garnett was the catalyst for a lot of that. On the court, he does seem to have been like, have a body type and a game that predates what we see now in the NBA.
Yeah, there's like a bunch of different ways you could read him as kind of a revolutionary figure. Like you mentioned, Chad, about the preps to pros. I mean, Kobe came from high school in 1996, but Garnett actually did it in 1995, and he was only the fourth player to come straight from high school to the NBA. And the three guys that did it before him were kind of edge case. It was Daryl Dawkins and Bill Willoughby and someone named Reggie Harding. From 1962. These were players that kind of, you know, found loopholes in the rules, but they didn't, sort of outright say, I'm going straight from high school to the NBA as because I'm a phenom, exactly, and because I can play. There's no place for me in college.
Right.
I am too good for the competition in college, and why should I waste my time there? And that's still kind of an argument, you know, with the NBA's age rule that is in place now. Not almost as a direct reaction to the Garnett sort of generation of players that included Tracy McGrady and LeBron James, in addition to Kobe and KG, you never had people talking about that before KG made that leap. So that's a way in which he's revolutionary. And like you mentioned, Kate, the money, what was he, the first $120 million player, or one of the first, at least in that class? He just had this contract structure that almost, you know, led in some ways to the lockout, I think, in 1999.
I think all those owners were like, you did what? And now we're going to have to do what?
Right.
And no.
Sort of overhauled the salary structure in reaction to contracts like
his. So you're saying that Kevin Garnett led to the lockout?
Well, I mean, I think he played
that is
a
in
role.
One, yeah,
that's like
in
one
piece,
interpretation.
Yeah.
In that, but not through his own fault, but because, you know, what is he going to do? Say no when the T-Wolves offer him that contract? But he was just, players like him were of such monumental talent at such a young age and were up for free agency at a younger age than any player before, that it forced teams to grapple with the idea of how much do you extend and how much do you give these guys for the first time.
So let's go to the advanced metric side rather than just sort of the extra stuff outside the court, off the court. So Neil, he was really good at something called box plus minus. Just run us through one more time, box plus minus.
Well, he was really good at the whole kind of family of plus minus stats. So box plus minus is one that
is
only uses box score stats.
What's box plus minus?
Is it like
what
an
role
uncle?
Does it play? Yeah.
I think it might be like a brother or something like that, like a sibling.
Like the crazy brother that you're out of touch with?
No, the brother that's more stable year to year.
The one you go to for advice.
Yeah, but
is it boring though? And you
might
feel
be
like
a little bit boring.
It's very vanilla.
Or, yeah, exactly. It doesn't use as much information. So I don't want to call it the dumb brother or something, but you know, it is of a family that also includes they're all from adjusted plus minus, which is this idea that you can adjusted plus minus might be the matriarch of the family. It was kind of quasi invented by a guy named Dan Rosenbaum, who, full disclosure, I used to work for with the Atlanta Hawks, but he kind of came up with this system that we've talked about this before in stat school, but it's this idea that you can figure out a player's true worth by looking at how the team does with him on the floor versus when he's not on the floor, after adjusting for all of his teammates and opponents also when he's on the
court.
And
you're saying that Kevin Garnett is beloved by all members of this family.
Garnett is beloved by all members of it, and it kind of goes back when I heard about his retirement and I was thinking about angles to write about or talk about. There's a story that Rosenbaum wrote which was called Picking the Difference Makers in the NBA, and it was kind of this introduction. It was in 2003, I want to say, of this metric, this adjusted plus minus metric, to the public. Previously, no one had really seen it in the public sphere, and Garnett came out as the best player in basketball by an enormous margin. He was judged to be 16.2 points better than the average player. Wow. Number two in the league at that time was Tracy McGrady, and he was only 12.6 points per 100 possessions better than average. So the gap between Garnett and McGrady was the same as the gap between McGrady at number two and Ray Allen at number eight
in
the league.
And what skill set? This is what I'm still trying to understand.
Right.
What skill set lent itself
guarding
to
the
being
pick and
so
roll.
Beloved? Like, you know, families are bickering bunch.
Was it his, like, wit? His candor?
Well, you know, Kevin Garnett was known for his candor and his political opinions at Thanksgiving. But no, I think it was versatility. I think that's the big thing with Kevin Garnett. And he was famous as being a player that he was actually 7 feet tall if you were to pick out a tape measure and actually measure him, but he refused to kind of have that be listed as his height. He wanted to be known as
under
7 feet, exactly.
Mobile.
Because he found that, you know, he felt like 7-footers had this reputation of being lumbering.
That might be a
That is absolutely true. Absolutely
you
true
measured
fact.
Him yourself.
Yeah, he was actually 7 feet tall, and he wanted to be known as under 7 feet tall because he wanted to shed this image of
In
the
my head,
footer.
He's 6'11". He's always 6 foot 11.
Exactly. That's the hard cap on his height. As a player of that height, you didn't expect him to be able to pass, break people down, you know, face up, break them down off the dribble, to be able to defend, you know, a little on the perimeter, you know, very well inside, to be able to switch, like you said, on pick and rolls, and be able to kind of be a rim protector, but also with his length, he was able to disrupt shots. He was able to shoot, you know, he's one of the great mid-range shooters of all time, which I think people, you know, don't always give him credit for, or perhaps, you know, didn't realize. So he was like this total package of a player that played offense and defense at such a high level, especially on defense. He might be the best player since Bill Russell in the NBA on defense. So that's the reason why the metrics really loved him as a player, was this just versatility that he showed on the floor that at his peak it was kind of unparalleled by any other player in the league.
And yet, there was, and still is to some degree, of course, the title with the Celtics dispelled this notion of Kevin Garnett as
a loser.
Yes. And also languishing sort of in the abyss of the NBA. But to some degree, it hit a tipping point where it wasn't just like, oh, he's on bad teams, but Kevin Garnett himself can't make those teams as good as they should be for the superstar that he should have been. And in a way, like, if I can relate it to this past week in the NFL, like, you had Terrell Pryor on the Browns. He's like, he played safety, right? He played wide receiver. He played quarterback. And you're like, isn't this amazing about who Terrell Pryor is? Or maybe the Cleveland Browns are so awful that how can a guy be one of your top players at all of these numerous positions? And so I think for a lot of people with Kevin Garnett, it was like, yes, he's guarding the pick and roll, he's rebounding, his mid-range, and all of these things that should account for a kind of versatility that transcends and makes him one of the best players. But then sometimes people only looked at it as that transcendent talent still is not carrying a team to the place it's supposed to be going.
Right, and I think that's another way in which Garnett kind of fits into the advanced stat era of the NBA, right? Because, first of all, before he sort of hit his peak, people weren't really, you know, advanced stats weren't actually kind of a thing. And once they finally started becoming a thing with John Hollinger as sort of proselytizing for it in the early to mid 2000s. That was when KG hit his peak and was like clearly statistically the best player. And I think that kind of got the conversation rolling in a direction. I mean, he certainly wasn't the first player where there was this argument of, oh, well, he's really great. Well, how come he hasn't won? Well, his teammates aren't that good. Well, he should be able to overcome that because this is the NBA. You know, Wilt Chamberlain went through that. There were other players in history.
Or
but
even
KG,
Allen Iverson, right, just a right. few years earlier.
Just to remind folks, the Timberwolves lost in the first round of the Western Conference playoffs, or in the playoffs in general, first round in the Western Conference, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years in a row
mm-hmm.
with Garnett as their big star.
Right.
But you also have to say, you know, they won 45 to 50 games around that amount every single year during that span. And you have to ask, how many games would they have won without Kevin Garnett? And I think that was the kind of exercise that we were finally starting to be able to put numbers on when Garnett was going through that string of losses and that string of, you know, disappointments, is that we were finally able to quantify and say, baseball has gone through this too in recent years of, does most valuable player mean the best player, or does it mean the player, best player on the team that did well? And how do you separate out value when a player's teammates are really bad? That was a conversation that perhaps didn't have to be made or didn't present itself in the NBA in the era before Garnett, because we had, if anything, Allen Iverson was a player whose teammates were underappreciated according to the advanced stats, and his own numbers were inflated and his own value was inflated by the advanced stats. And then you had Michael Jordan and you had Karl Malone and you had people like that in the 90s that, you know, their value and their team sort of were commensurate with each other.
Right.
So there was no debate. But with Garnett, you had the singular instance of the best statistical player in the league is saddled with these kind of mediocre teammates and didn't go far in the playoffs. And so it really brought that discussion, I think, to the fore. And then when Garnett finally did make it to the Celtics, you know, you finally got to see that, oh, well, he actually is capable of playing well when he gets to play with other good players.
But KG in his prime also got hampered with another layer that statistics would illuminate in the future, which was playing with Stephon Marbury, which I think to perhaps people in Minnesota seeing it every day, they could articulate that Marbury's numbers were probably not commensurate with what he was offering the team. But to the national audience, you're like, you got Stephon Marbury. You know, like, that's a guy with this kind of talent, and look at the numbers he's producing. And then it became another knock on KG. But then later on, statistics would, in the rearview mirror, show that Stephon Marbury was wildly overrated.
Right, and for the same reason that Garnett was perhaps underrated, because these statistics, especially the adjusted plus-minus, to bring it back to that, were able to talk about defense, and defense is something that we really couldn't measure before the mid, you know, early to mid-2000s with any kind of statistical accuracy in the NBA, and that turned out to be what Kevin Garnett was like an all-time amazing player at, and turned out to be kind of what Stephon Marbury was bad at. And
except in China. He's like really good.
Right. He's
China.
A lockdown defender in China, I'm sure. But yeah, exactly. So, you know, Kevin Garnett's legacy was enhanced at the same time that he came of age as an all-time great player by the fact that we were able to measure more accurately the things that he was an all-timer at.
It's been so long since we talked about the NBA.
I know,
forgot how much fun it is to wind you guys up and let it go.
The enthusiasm we both just had that we dove into the NBA right there.
I have another question, but I worry it's going to lead to 10 more minutes of audio.
Another rabbit hole.
So I think we should probably leave it there.
Chad, what a tease.
And I mean,
this.
It was just media day for the NBA, so we were about to launch back into the NBA. I think it was the perfect time.
I totally agree. All right, real quick.
Okay.
Quickly.
If advanced stats were around now, or sorry, when Kevin Garnett was in his prime.
They kind of were. Right.
Well, if they were as adopted, do you think that
would he have been traded?
That's my question, A. Or B, do you think that the Timberwolves would have been able to build a better team around him because they would have had a better sense of what to do with – I mean, you've seen that with the Warriors with Draymond Green a little bit,
right.
Is that, you know, you can have these versatile players and you can think about different roles more easily.
Yeah, I think that part especially, like, his game resembles more of the game that's played now than the game that was played when he first came out of high school into the NBA, and for the same reason that he, in a weird way, kind of relating to what we talked about earlier about him not wanting to be seen as the lumbering, you know, 7-foot center or whatever, is that there are no lumbering 7-foot centers anymore. He is the prototype now for, you know, Serge Ibaka. I mean, you know, a pale comparison to Kevin Garnett in his prime, but there are players that sort of are in that archetype that have come up and lived their whole lives emulating KG.
Like Nowitzki, almost, even though I know he's
being
same,
able to
like,
shoot,
right.
You know, as a 7-foot, near 7-foot player.
And that maybe is where the revolution really comes in the sense that it players that break molds in the NBA especially end up altering the market of what skill sets and who is desirable in the draft and
right.
coming over from Europe and things like that. And so in that sense, Neil, what I'm really taking away from what you're saying is that the personnel in the NBA would be different
right.
if Kevin Garnett had
Yeah, because it's almost like he forces you, if you want to win, to put different people around him. But until you can name what you need, and I don't think Minnesota could in the mid to late 90s, it was just like you had this guy who could do amazing things, but you didn't know what you needed around him yet.
All right, so let's leave it there and move on to our significant digit. When a telling number from the world of sports lands on our doorstep, Neil Payne, you have brought this telling number from the world of sports. You've plucked it out of sports to tell us something. What have you brought?
That is correct. So this week's Sig Dig is the number 67. That is the number of years that Vin Scully has been in the broadcast booth and, you know, the number of years he's been a professional broadcaster. Vin Scully, of course, is the longtime, 67 years worth, longtime voice of the Dodgers from Brooklyn to Los Angeles. And he will be calling his final game this weekend at age 88. This is his, you know, final season. There have been a lot of tributes streaming in to Vin Scully. He's one of the most beloved broadcasters and television personalities of all time. So rather than me wax on about him, I think it would be better for me to just shut up and let him do what he is the best at. Here's a clip of him talking about Jose Fernandez, who we talked about at the top of the show, the late, great Jose Fernandez, and the things that he used to do to train to be a great baseball player when he was in his native Cuba. Take it away, Vin.
Fernandez, born in Cuba, 6'3", 220. Only 24 in July. Off speed and up, and he went after it. When Fernandez was a little kid, and he chases that one, all he would do is hit rocks with a stick. He'd take a paper sack from his home, and he'd go searching for rocks that had to be a good size, like a baseball. And he'd spend his day hitting them with sticks. Winds up not a hitter, but a pitcher.
So I have a confession to make.
Please.
I think Vin Scully's good.
Oh, Chad.
Are
you backlashing?
I have no ill will against Vin Scully. I've never not enjoyed myself listening to Vin Scully call a baseball game. I don't get what the fuss is about.
See, I'm assuming that you did grow up listening to baseball, like when you would drive around and
Absolutely.
Stuff. I think it's probably just for people whose, like, baseball lives have been filled with the sound of his voice. He's like a friend.
Sure, but it goes outside of Los Angeles, right? So, like, I feel very attached to the Mets announcers.
That's what I mean. Like, Mets announcers from when in the 80s and 90s?
Well, yeah, Chad, but he also was a national announcer. He holds the all-time record for most World Series called at 25. A lot of great moments. Right, exactly. Before Joe Buck, there was Vin Scully. Talk about a drop-off. But, you know, you have...
Woo! Burn!
Yeah.
Coming in hot all over this sig dig.
But what I'm saying, what I want to say about Vin Scully is that he's a storyteller, right? Like, he is able to kind of weave this narrative through a game and talk about, you know, the conversations that he's had and the backgrounds that he's kind of been able to cull from talking to the players and weave it into the story of the game, the grander narrative of the game. I think he represents something also.
You heard that in the Rocks, Jose Hernandez hitting Rocks in Cuba.
Sure, exactly.
Story.
I mean, he has little vignettes and anecdotes like that about every player that comes through Dodger Stadium. But I also think it's important that he is a relic. He's the last of a certain class of broadcaster, a certain type of broadcaster that you probably will never see again, never hear again in the game of baseball. Today's broadcasters, they have that very like distinct broadcasterly voice that sounds very kind of like overcooked and very like overly enthusiastic and in some ways phony to certain moments.
I like Vin Scully, voice medium rare.
Right. Well, Vin Scully kind of has this very smooth voice and he's telling a story. It's almost like you're sitting down with an old friend or an old, you know, uncle or something telling you about the sport and about the game and kind of weaving it into your life. And I think there's something to that that is going to be lost probably forever when he calls his final game. And it's a little sad. I mean, baseball is all about kind of hearkening back to earlier eras. And there's something, you know, it's not always for the best, this nostalgia that we as baseball fans kind of try to imprint onto the game. We talked about Jose Fernandez. He represented something that was sort of in opposition to, and in a good way, that tradition and that stodginess of baseball. But I think Vin Scully represents all that's great about the history of baseball. He's an encyclopedic figure about that, and he's able to kind of fit that history and that narrative into the current game seamlessly, and he represents, like we said, the sig dig itself, 67 years of history in one person telling the story of the game.
Are you angry at Chad that Chad took a shot at him?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think there are certainly schools of thought.
I'll know when Neil's angry.
Oh, you have known in the past, but you know,
there is a bit of tension between you two sometimes. I wonder if you guys are working on a story at various points.
We go back to the beginning of 538 rookie camp together back in the day. But
it all started at rookie camp.
That's right. Yes.
Can we bring the show home, or do you?
Do you want to keep talking about Vin Scully?
I could talk about Vin Scully for a long time.
I believe that you could.
That is evident.
That maybe we should leave it there. But the game will be different without him in it starting next season, and a little part of baseball history will be missed.
Yeah, we got all that.
All right, that will do it for this week's show, Neil Payne. Thanks for regaling us with your own storytelling about the storyteller.
Anytime. Maybe I'll just do a cold open and say it's time for Hot Takedown at the beginning of next show.
Is that a Vin Scullyism?
Yeah. Time for Dodger baseball. Come on.
Kate Fagan, thanks for being my co-pilot here.
Thanks for listening to Neil today.
Yeah, exactly. Our podcast producer is Joe Sykes. Our podcast broadcaster is Jody Avergan. We get production assistance from Tony Chow, Jorge Estrada, and Jonathan Yales. You can email us at podcasts@538.com. We would love to hear what you think. You can find us on iTunes. Please go and review and rate the show. It helps others find the show. It'd be great, you know, if we made a little autumn push, a little autumn review drive, pledge drive. We should have a little auction, you know. Whoever reviews us the most gets to, hear us give a hot take.
Gets to download our next podcast.
Yeah, a real treat, free of charge. We are on other apps as well. Find us, rate us, review us, etc. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.